This is a CNA podcast.
Welcome to Heart of the Matter, and I'm Lin Su Ling. After months of staying, working, and eating at home, many people welcomed the announcement that Singapore will be transitioning into phase two of our COVID-19 new normal come Friday. Shops were open, you can eat at your favorite restaurant again, and even resume your gym sessions. But some lingering questions remain over the restrictions and guidelines rolled out to make this opening safe, and the considerations that shape these rules. What will Friday and this Father's Day weekend bring? Is a second wave of infections inevitable? If so, is Singapore ready? Calling in to tackle these issues and more on this episode are Teo Yik Ying, Dean of the Saw Swee Hock School of Public Health. Hi, Yik Ying.
Hi there.
Dale Fisher, Senior Consultant at the National University Hospital and Chair of the WHO Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network.
Hi.
Welcome, gentlemen. Now, I understand that you're both fathers, and since restaurants and shops will be open on Sunday, how are you planning to spend Father's Day?
Well, Dale, you could go ahead first.
I'll probably spend it how I spend every Sunday. I have a family Zoom at 9:30. That includes my three kids. So I've got one in New York, one in Melbourne, and one in Sydney. And my mother and my sister are the ones that usually come on. Sometimes my brother comes on, but because we're scattered, we do a big Zoom every week. Then I usually spend the rest of the day, I'll try and get some exercise in. But the best thing about Sundays is that I get to catch up on my emails.
Oh gosh, so staying in there. What about you, YY?
Well, I'll be staying in as well. And in fact, we had a chance to celebrate Father's Day over the last weekend. So we did that on Sunday. I ordered some food to my parents, and then at home, my kids celebrated for me as well. So we are going to avoid the crowd in many ways this coming Sunday. So it will be a quiet Sunday for us at home.
You know, I got to say, I'm really surprised because in a Facebook poll that we ran, our followers say they look forward to visiting friends, loved ones, but they'll probably stay away from crowded places. That said, a handful said they can't wait to go back to Daiso, IKEA, and even the mall. So just throwing this out, you know, as infectious disease and public health experts, does that make you nervous?
It's time to open up, but everything has to be cautious. I see that you're allowed to have dinner with five people, and that can be in a restaurant, and you can have them round to your house, but that doesn't mean you have to. I'd still like people to think that phase one was still in some ways the social norm, if you like, but you had an opportunity to do some of the things that are offered in phase two. It doesn't mean you have to go and do them. So I'd still like to see general contact maintained. Don't go to IKEA because you can. Go to IKEA because you need something, and go in, do it, buy it, and then go out. The risk is low, but cases and clusters are going to appear, and we don't want to have to tighten up the social restrictions again.
Do you share those sentiments? Why?
Oh, definitely. Well, the first message is that we should acknowledge that everyone has played their part to minimize infection risk to themselves and to the community over the past 10 weeks. And that past 10 weeks have certainly been very difficult for many families, especially families with elderly parents and people who have not seen their best friends, good friends, boyfriends, girlfriends for 10 weeks. Certainly, the reopening, it's a good approach. It's a good time for people now to get together. But I completely agree with what Dale has mentioned. The coronavirus has not become less transmissible or less infectious because we've moved towards phase two. It remains what it is. The risk still remains. While we are allowed to go back to some of our activities, we really have to be very sensible about what we want to do. Just because we can dine with four other friends doesn't mean that we will do this with different groups of four people today, tomorrow, and so on. So we really have to be very sensible and prudent in terms of how we make use of this freedom that we have very painfully regained.
Well, it sounds like both of you are urging caution, but surely you were quite relieved when you heard the announcement. Share with us, what was coursing through your mind when you heard the announcement on Monday of Singapore's move to phase two of reopening? Dale, you mentioned that some relief and some reprieve is actually welcomed.
You only do what's necessary. And when you've had for some time now only single figure cases in the community, it's okay to ease things, but it's how you ease and how socially responsible people are. Yeah, I like to know that I can now invite some friends around for dinner. But as YY said, I'm not going to do it every day. And actually, I don't want to, but Why do we want to push the boundaries? Take it as a privilege, if you like, the phase two, and say, good, we're allowed to do that. I don't want to blow it.
So why? I mean, it sounds as if this whole moving towards reopening the economy is somewhat of a surprise. Are you surprised? Because previously, authorities did say that it will take at least 4 weeks after phase one to shift into phase two.
Well, I suppose the announcement did come at a time that it's much needed, because now you could see the impact on unemployment, especially an impact on retail and some of the restaurants and eating outlets. It is a good time from an economic perspective. From a public health perspective, this is also a good time because we have seen that the number of cases in the community have indeed fallen very steadily and remain consistently low. So in many ways, the signs are good, but it doesn't mean that if the signs are good, we can take advantage of that and then just go back to all the kind of interactions and activities that we enjoyed back in January. The reality is that we have seen what has happened in Beijing. Even New Zealand, they have eliminated the virus, but we have seen that there are two travelers who came in, and because of compassionate reasons, now New Zealand has to scramble to try and contain the situation. So in many ways, as we ease some of the measures, outbreaks can happen again in Singapore. So we have to recognize that that is a reality.
But that's the thing. When Singapore first mentioned a phased approach in May or so, it was described as very careful, very controlled. But there's a sense that we have swung to the other side, where everything opens up as a default. That's what Minister Lawrence Wong had described.
Well, that's true, because now you could see that the schools will be reopening on the 29th of June in about 1.5 weeks' time. Dining in, retail has resumed, sports facilities, social gatherings are now allowed. But in many ways, I would say that the situation that Singapore is in now is no different from what we have in February or in early March, where the number of cases in the community swings between 5 to 10.
And when we were back then, I remember, I think it was the day before the circuit breaker started, we had 70 cases in the community. Now, that was at a time where Singapore was really leading the world in terms of its response. It had good contact tracing. We isolated all our cases. We did widespread testing. We did all those public health things quite well, and it still wasn't enough. So what that tells me is that we need more. Now, we've got a lot more mask wearing happening, so that will help. But the efforts in terms of social distancing and not having crowds are what is needed. We know there'll be cases and clusters, but as Korea has shown, they have cases and clusters, but they jump on them very quickly. So we want less cases and clusters, and we want small cases and clusters. And this can be achieved by only having the small groups and social distancing. The response needs to be swift and broad. So if there is a cluster in a market, say like in China, then we need to be all over that. There needs to be a lot of testing, a lot of quarantine to really break that transmission chain quickly.
So I thought this would be a good time for us to shift into thinking about the rules which have been applied and the rules which have been relaxed. There's been a plethora of different rules for different activities. But maybe we can do this through a quick true or false segment. So we know that reopening the economy will require some change. And what I'll do is I'll read you a list of rules for Singapore's phase two, and you both tell me for each one if it's true or if I've made it up. How does that sound?
We better take it in turns to go first.
All right, so here we go. Number one, there are five of these. So number one, foreign domestic workers should stay at home during their rest days. True or false?
True.
False.
Aha, it's false. That's an advisory from a week ago. It doesn't apply to phase two.
I think YY is saying they should stay at home.
That's not the advisory that I'm asking about.
Well, but because we would actually still recommend that, if possible, that they minimize any outdoor travel. Just like, even though we can go out now in phase two, it doesn't mean, like what Dale has mentioned, we see it as a privilege, but it doesn't mean that we must execute that privilege.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'm just getting your sense on whether these rules that are from the Singapore government are true or if I've made it up. But let's go through the list, and I guess it will give us a lot of fodder for the rest of the conversation.
It's 1-0, I like this.
So number two, no browsing allowed in bookstores. Read book summaries online. True or false?
Wow.
I know we can't go to the library yet, but browsing in bookstores, I would think that that's false. You're allowed to browse in bookstores.
I'm going to say it's true.
Oh, another split one. It's false. You are encouraged to read the book summaries online, but you're advised to minimize browsing.
Oh, that's what I meant.
Number three. We're going quite fast on this then. Nursing home visits can resume, subject to a maximum of 2 visitors per patient each day.
False. I think it's 1 patient each day, but you are allowed to have 2 registered people visit you.
Yeah, that's what I think. I know they're allowed visitors again, and I think it's probably 1. It was certainly 1 before the circuit breaker.
I have good news. Everybody got it correct. Number 4, a maximum of 20 people in restaurants at any one time.
Wow, I didn't read about that. So I'm going to guess false.
I know it's maximum 5 per table and they don't have to distance, but the tables have to distance. But I haven't seen 20 as the maximum for a restaurant, so I'm going to say it's false.
You got that right, Dale. It's false. It's a limitation of 5 a group for dining in, but the restrictions on restaurants is based on how much you can distance people. Okay, last one, gentlemen. Solemnization and wedding banquets can proceed with safe distancing and precautions, subject to a maximum of 20 people.
Yes, I think that's true.
I think it's 10.
So, true or false?
I think it's 10, so that's false.
Well, solemnizations can happen. You could have 20 people show up, but I think the trick here is that you lumped in both solemnizations and wedding banquets. I'm going to say you could have 20 people attend solemnizations, but I think banquets have to be restricted to 10 people.
Actually, this is the only thing that is true in the whole gamut of things that I mentioned. It's maximum of 20 people for solemnization and wedding banquets. But that's the thing, isn't it? Like, these rules are coming swift and fast after Monday, and various government agencies are trying to get businesses and organizations and people to adhere to that. But it's really quite challenging. For me, most of all, it's that the numbers, you know, there are different permutations for different activities. 20 for weddings, 5 for visits, no alcohol past a certain times, and even concerning foreign domestic workers on weekend, what's the advisory? Do you have a sense of, you know, based on your experience in a pandemic setting, how countries do it? How do you think these rules are arrived at? What are the factors that go into these permutations? Because people have asked, why 5? Why not 6, 7, or 4?
As far as I know, there is really no science that could tell us why it's 5 or why it's not 4 or 10 or any other number. And it's entirely an experiment that we are trying to find out what worked and what didn't. Effectively, I like to use the word, we stress test the system. If at 5 people interacting, whether it is for meals or for gatherings at home, we start to see that cases in the community go up. That's when we realize that, all right, even when I give people the luxury to have 5 people come together, it is abuse or it is still not appropriate, and then we may need to scale it back down. And if at 5 it works well, we can then move on and relax this even further. So I don't think there's any science behind it, but I'm happy to be proven wrong by Dale, who could probably come up with a very good reason why it's 5. Over to you, Dale.
That's why I let you go first, why?
No stress, Dale, no stress.
I think you have to give a number, and I do think it's arbitrary. But if you just said keep numbers in restaurants at tables low, then people are going to say what's low. So you have to give a number, and I agree. I think they're arbitrary, just trying to find something that's practical. I was quite interested that they said you don't have to distance when you're at the table in a restaurant. And I thought that was sensible, if you like. It seems to go against what we're saying. You can take a mask off and be within a meter, but you don't have the dining experience if you tell people to be a meter apart at a table.
But there are still safe distances that need to be adhered to between tables, between different groups though. So actually the question might be, if you keep to those safe distancing rules, why not leave it as that? Why prescribe specific caps on activities, 20 people for weddings or whatnot?
Well, it's because I think they have to give a number, and 20 is still reasonable to get the closest family together. So that, I guess, is why they picked that number rather than 5, because then you say, well, basically that's 4 parents and 1 other. So that doesn't get your brothers and sisters in or a grandparent. I think the numbers are just there because you need a number. You can't be qualitative about it.
The other question that arises, of course, is why is it that some activities are permitted but others, you know, discouraged? The example that comes to mind is that schools can resume from June 29th onwards, but work from home remains the default.
Well, I think the reality is that we really want to minimize people interacting, because that is the setting that the virus gets spread. If we have seen from the past 2-3 months that there are some work that can be executed just the same at home. We minimize this group of people going out, taking public transportation, having lunches out there. And that helps to minimize the number of people moving around in society. And that is always a good thing to try and keep this in check.
We've done home-based learning for kids as well, though. Are we saying that that's not working out?
Well, I think for home-based learning, there are many reasons why it increases inequity amongst children from different socioeconomic demography. I would strongly support the idea that schools resume. And in fact, in many instances, based on the data that we have shown, I mean, Dale can chime in on this. We still think that children have a low risk of being infected. And when infected, they may have very low risk of having severe complications. There are that few cases that have been reported on children having Kawasaki-like syndrome. But I have to emphasize, those are very, very rare, that emerged only in countries with very widespread infections.
Yeah, I agree. We always agree, except in the true-false. We still don't think children are significantly involved in the outbreak. Yes, they can get it. They're largely asymptomatic. But do they take it home and cause more spread? We think it's not a big significant factor in driving the outbreak. They usually get it, but they don't pass it on. Schools have been controversial across the world, actually. People have really not known what to do with them. We know that schools increase a lot more movement. Parents have to pick them up. They have to mingle afterwards. It crowds the public transport. So it has been controversial. But of course, then when you close schools, then parents can't work and they need to stay home. And indeed, often it can get worse with the grandparents having to step in, and we're trying to leave the grandparents alone. So I'm a fan of schools opening, and I think work from home for adults, I think it's a revelation for a number of reasons. I think most people that can do it because of the nature of their jobs are finding it's very, very efficient and will be reluctant to let it go at the end of all this.
So it sounds like you're saying there are policy reasons to target specific activities or groups of people, which brings me to this other point. So foreign domestic workers have been specifically advised to avoid congregating in large groups on their rest day as Singapore moves into phase two. And they're also advised not to, quote unquote, gather or loiter in public spaces or visit crowded places like City Plaza, Lucky Plaza and Peninsula Plaza, even considering taking their off day on a weekday. What do you both make of these specific guidelines issued for this group of people?
I don't see that to be very different from what the government is asking the rest of the population to do, which is, even though you can go out, you minimize your outward travel as much as possible to only the real necessity, that you're going out for a reason that is necessary. It's the same for the domestic helpers as well. There is a tendency, because of their social habits, they will go out, they will come together with friends, just like we want to meet up with our friends. They can right now in phase two. And again, the reminder is that just because you can doesn't mean that you will abuse that privilege and go to crowded places. So I see that to be very much in line with the recommendations that are given to everyone else in Singapore. I don't see that as actually a separate group. There is a separate reminder to employers. Yes, I think that is necessary, because employers otherwise will come up with their own rules of what they can or cannot do. That separate reminder is just to remind the employers. So it's not to segregate the domestic helpers as a different group with different privileges.
This is a little bit of a problem, actually, because that's exactly what they do. And you remember before I said what our aim should be is to have less clusters, and when they occur, they're smaller. So obviously, if you get these sort of congregating, then there's a risk that they'll be big. And we know sort of what happened at Mustafa is another great place for congregating. But we have to give foreign workers something else to do. They do love getting together, and those places you mentioned before are obviously very familiar on a Sunday. But some activities, things to do, I think, are what's lacking. And this is also going to be for the dormitory workers as well, because they're all going to get their Sunday off. And I think we need to work a little bit harder on off-day activities, which can be taken up, which is culturally appropriate. It's actually things that they enjoy doing, and it can be done safely. But just saying don't do things is only half the job. You've also got to say, don't do this because now you can do this.
So circling back to sort of off-work activities for Singaporeans or just people living in Singapore in general, there's this other thing about how there seems to be a time bar for specific activities. For instance, no alcohol sales past 10:30 p.m. What do you make of that?
I guess it's because when people drink alcohol, they're going to be less wary of their behavior. You would never be in a pub, for instance, social distancing a meter apart. That's and even if you started that way, after a couple of beers, I'm sure you're going to be standing close to people. And of course, then it can get noisy and people start yelling.
But why past 10:30 though? It's not a ban for alcohol. It's a ban on alcohol past 10:30.
Again, I think it's just another arbitrary number. 10:30 means people can still socialize, but it means we're not going on to midnight or more, where people will have consumed more alcohol. Again, I think there's no great science to this. It's just a way of restricting. And obviously, if people have had too much to drink, then all those social distancing rules are going to go out the door with the mask.
So I just want to bring the conversation to look forward. As you mentioned, New Zealand and China seem to be cautionary tales, and that fear of a second wave is very real after news this week of another cluster of cases in Beijing and then two cases in New Zealand. Is that resurgence of infections inevitable as the economy reopens? And what do you both think lessons are that we can learn from these examples?
In many ways, I think the Singapore government and the public, we will all have to be mentally prepared that with greater easing, it becomes even more likely that we will have one, two, or even more of those unfortunate incidents or events that we read about happening in other countries that result in some degree of community transmission. Exactly like what you said, is inevitable. It is extremely difficult to avoid having some increase in community transmission. What is more important is whether Singapore as a country, we have the processes in place to catch this community cases quickly and then to perform the necessary contact tracing, identify all possible people who have been exposed, isolate, test them quickly.
But what, in your view, is the early indicator that we should look out for that suggests we might have to even slap circuit breakers together or try to address a cluster?
This is where, when you get new cases coming on, are you able to link them to existing clusters? It goes back to the situation in February and March. Do we know where these new cases that are being reported daily, are they coming from clusters that we already know about and we have isolated and quarantined these people, and after a few days, they report that they are infected? Or are they popping up from different parts of Singapore completely unsuspected and unexpected? And if it's the second situation, then I think it is a much more worrying trend, and that's where we need to look at perhaps more restriction measures putting back on. Dale, what are your thoughts to that?
Oh, I agree. I agree completely. Unlinked cases are a real red flag. When these are published on the MOH website each day, they're unlinked at the time of diagnosis. That doesn't mean they remain unlinked. So it's really important to be able to link them eventually. And so you find a case randomly and then you say, oh, okay, they were at such and such a place the week before. So now that's linked. We can be comfortable with that knowledge. So cases that remain unlinked are a red flag that there's unidentified transmission happening. And that would be the main flag, I guess. To find those cases, we need to have a very low index of suspicion to test. I'm not sure what the latest guidelines on that are, but I would like to think that any upper respiratory infection could get a swab because of the situation we've got now. And actually, there's very little in terms of colds and flus going around because of the circuit breaker. It would be very reasonable to have a low index of suspicion for testing and then finding out if they're an unlinked case. The other interesting thought, and I think it's still a thought, is sewage testing or wastewater. Finding it in our wastewater in an area where there's not supposed to be cases would be a reason to heighten the surveillance.
Might travel be the blind spot that throws up the next big infection, though? I think people were spooked by the news of the Bangladeshi man who had COVID-19 and brought back memories where imported cases were the majority. Are you both confident of the regime imposed for travellers to Singapore in preempting cases?
At the moment, they're all still being put in quarantine for 2 weeks, right? So cases that are imported shouldn't be transmitting because they're isolated for the incubation period.
But I think there is a point to be made that with phase two, we will relax some of this 2 weeks quarantine from staying in government-appointed facilities to staying at home. And at least I'm glad to see that the list of countries that travelers are coming from are allowed to stay at home. That list is very well curated, but I do think that it has to remain a dynamic list of countries, meaning that the policymakers really need to constantly evaluate the situation in those countries and then make the decision whether they can still remain as 14 days quarantine at home versus 14 days quarantine in a government-appointed facility. Because we clearly wouldn't want a repeat of what happened in March again, when returning travellers seed more infections in the community because they were staying at home.
So there's this suggestion going around by Nobel laureate Paul Romer, his plan to reopen the US economy responsibly, which is basically a suggestion for testing everybody every 14 days or so. Does this idea have legs, or do you both think it's a moonshot, and why?
That would be a logistic nightmare. Even if we were to do that in Singapore, just to do the maths of 5.7 million divided by 14, I'm not sure what that is, but it's going to be a couple of hundred thousand cases every day for so long. So we don't have that capacity. I'm not sure any country's got that sort of capacity. And that's only the swabbing. Who's going to do all the swabs and the reagents? So I think we can be smarter than just mindlessly swabbing the whole population.
Not to mention that it's going to cost the country $1.2 billion just to test everyone every month.
Yeah.
Oh, that's quite a lot.
We could be much smarter by having a very liberal approach to testing anyone with symptoms. If a diagnosis is made, then you'd swab with a very wide ring, so sort of like ring swabbing. So any contact, even remotely, someone that's been to the same place as you at the same time, you could do this in a much smarter way than just swabbing everyone. And that will shut down transmission chains.
So just rounding off this podcast, did you have any parting shots to leave with our listeners as people get ready to go out tomorrow?
My view is stay within the rules and don't push the rules to the limit just because you can. Regard them as a little bit of a privilege and don't forget what the circuit breaker was like. It's very conceivable that we would have to go back into that. Everyone has a role to play. We talk about the community, but the community is made up of many individuals, and every individual has a role to play in terms of being responsible, and then we'll get through it. And if there's visitors come into Singapore, then they have to abide by our rules as well, which is all the distancing and the mask wearing and things like that.
I'm just going to end off with one scenario that I'll give to the listeners. I've read on social media how some of the restaurants serving hot pot are almost completely booked out for this weekend. And I think that with more easing, people, there will be groups of people that will start rushing out again. And I think collectively, we may become less careful with the precautionary measures. This can have the possibility of clusters popping up in a community like what we talk about. And if that happens, the reality is we may need to regress back to phase one or even close down many more sectors again. And while many people like to think that, oh, I won't be the one that it's spreading, let's look at what history has taught us. About 100 years ago, we saw the Spanish flu pandemic. The second wave actually infected many more people and resulted in many more deaths. And I like to think that people back then weren't any less sensible than us now. If they were as sensible, what happened back then? And if we just extrapolate the lessons learned back then to what we are going to do with our own actions in the next few days, the next few weeks in phase two, I think this is where we should still be very careful with our own individual action. Let's not repeat history, a very painful history.
Why would I just mention deaths back in the 1918 flu? I think people might be forgetting that too, because Singapore has done really well in terms of mortality from this illness. And people need to remember that this is a deadly illness. Sure, it's very uncommon to die if you're a child or a young adult, but the young adults are the ones transmitting it, increasing the transmission chains, and eventually it gets to someone who's in their 60s or 70s, and that's someone's parent, someone's grandparent, and they're the ones that have got a high risk of dying. So just because you're thinking it doesn't affect me, increasing the spread will result in parents and grandparents dying from this. I think we've got to keep the context of why we're doing all this.
So wise words of caution there for everybody. Thanks YY and Dale for joining us today. There you have it, your burning questions over Singapore's move to phase two answered by the experts. And the people who make this podcast possible, Crispina Robert, our podcast editor, and Erin Low, our research writer. I'm Lin Suling, signing off from this episode of Heart of the Matter.